And that was the blood stain from the carpet.
And that's found in State Exhibits 79 and 80?
Correct.
Did you perform DNA testing on that?
Yes, I did.
Now I'm going to show you this chart. Can you tell us what we're seeing here in this chart?
Yes. So, as I mentioned a minute ago, explaining DNA, the alleles, or the number of times that that little section is repeated, that turns out to be a number. So in the table, the main body of the table, you're going to see a lot of numbers. Those are just those number of repeat that we're seeing in that particular section. The top table, why there's two tables, is the top table is Profiler Plus, is labeled across the top, and the bottom table is listed as Cofiler. Those are just the names of the amplification kits that we use with this process. The reason why there's two tables and there was two kits, in order to get to the 13 loci or locations that we were testing, we used two separate kits to get to that number of 13. There's actually two loci or locations that are duplicated between those kits. So Profiler Plus has D3, which is a location. A Cofiler also has D3, which is the same location. So those numbers should match and be similar, as well as D7. D7 is another location that we test for, and so we can do a comparison to make sure that those samples are amplifying or copying the same between each kit. So if you look at the table and to read the table, on the left-hand column is you can see Q1, Q2, Q3, Q4, Q5, Q6, Q7, and Q8. And then V1, S1. So that's just the name of the sample that I'm testing and reporting on. And then across the first row is the name of the kit, Profiler Plus. The second row is the name of the location, or the loci that I'm testing for. So the second column, you can't see it that well, but it says AMEL, which stands for amelogenin, which that's the sex-determining characteristic reporting site. So Q1, you can see in amelogenin, if you look at the Q1, follow that across to that second column, there's an XX, so we know that that sample is a female sample. And then as I do my processing and my interpretation, I just, once I find the allele calls, I put them into the table. That's what you're seeing.
Talk about the findings as to that Q1 sample. What did you conclude?
So my conclusions were that sample Q1 was a single source female, and then comparing that to the known standards that I have, it matched sample V1, which is a standard from CERN-RMU.
What do you mean by a single source?
So with the DNA question sample, a swab, a blood stain, there could be one contributor, two contributors, three contributors. We don't know until we do DNA. Once I do DNA and get the resulting electropherogram, which is kind of the printout of what I'm visualizing, I can look at the number of peak heights that I'm seeing, or the peaks that I'm seeing, and I can determine how many contributors there could have been to that sample. So if you remember, half your DNA is inherited from your mom, half is inherited from your dad. So you should have two numbers in our chart. Well, the way that that's visualized with our DNA instrument is that we actually see those as peaks. So as it comes off the instrument, we see these peaks on our electropherogram. So if I see two peaks, then I'm comfortable that that's a one-person sample. If I see a single peak, that means that that one person could be sharing the 10 and the 10, one 10 from the mom, a 10 from the dad. So looking at an electropherogram or those printouts, I can determine that. If a sample has more than one person, and I start seeing maybe three peaks, now I know that there's got to be one person could be two of those peaks, and the second person could be the third peak. Or if I see four, I could say one person could be those two peaks, another person could be those two peaks. So when I say single source, I'm talking about that looking at the overall profile, I only saw at most two peaks at each of those different locations, was able to say that there's only one contributor to that sample.
And then because in Q1 you have an XX, you can say that this sample is female sample.
Right.
And should report a single female source.
Correct.
So we want it to Q2. This would be found in State Exhibit 82, blood on the west wall of marker 12. Did you perform DNA testing to reference?
I did.
And do we see that in now this diagram, your chart?
Yes.
Here. Is this sample, Q2, a single source?
No, it is not.
And why is it not?
And that, again, because of the number of alleles, or those peaks that I see in my electropherogram, which then interpret into the numbers that you see there, you see there's a lot more numbers within that table, indicating that it's a mixture of more than one person's DNA.
In mixtures, are you able to determine like a major or a minor profile?
Yes, we can.
Tell me how that works.
So, the electropherogram, again, if you're thinking of these peaks that I'm seeing and visualizing, there's within this process of amplifying and copying, we can tell what are termed sister alleles. That means that if there's four peaks at one location, and if two of those peaks are pretty close in peak height and the other two are pretty low, we can do some math based off of how high they are to determine if those sister alleles belong to each other. So the way I do that is if I look at the two high peaks and I look at their peak height and what the ratio is to each other, if they're within 70%, then I can say that, yeah, those most likely belong together. Then I look at these two lower ones and I can do the same to them. If they're within 70%, yeah, those two most likely belong together. Then I'll compare one of the tall, big ones to a smaller one and see what that peak height ratio is. And if it's below that 70%, so a lot of time, you know, just throwing out a number, it could be 30% of each other. And I can say, okay, this is the major contributor, this is the minor contributor. And I can do that throughout the whole profile based off of peak heights and their relationship to each other.
Tell me, with regards to DNA, is there more DNA in certain types of samples than others?
Yes.
How does that work? So, for example, well, where does DNA come from off the human body?
So, DNA is found in the nucleated cells of your body. So, in blood, the red blood cells do not have a nucleus. So, in blood, your DNA is actually coming from white blood cells. They're a cell that has a nucleus. In seminal fluid, the spermatozoa have DNA in there. In your skin cells, either if it's skin cells from just your hands or the inside of your cheeks. When we talk about saliva, the saliva doesn't have DNA, but it's the actual cells that are sloughed off from your cheeks that are in your saliva that we're getting DNA from.
So from these various sources, which has the most, it's packed with more DNA than others?
Well, that really depends on the amount of sample you have. You know, if I have a lot of blood versus a little bit of saliva, you know, it's all relative to type or how much you have. I don't know if that answers.
But if you had equal amounts of skin DNA versus blood DNA, would the quantities be the amount, or I guess...
Are you talking skin DNA from like your hand touching something?
The touch DNA versus blood DNA. Pull off more DNA.
Yeah, from my experience, I would say that you'd have more in your blood sample than if something had just been touched. Oftentimes, if it's saliva, there's a lot of, you've got a lot of cells that are sloughing off inside your mouth. So usually that's a really good source of DNA.
In your process of amplification, that PCR process, you have a major and minor profile. Can a major profile overwhelm the minor profile?
Yes, it can.
Tell me how that works.
Well, if you remember, as the amplification process is where you break apart the DNA and you're building it back up with the agents in the amplification kit. So if your starting material, if you have a lot of DNA, say from a blood sample versus something that's been touched, the likelihood of those reagents reacting with DNA from the blood, because there's so much of that in there, you're going to be able to react with that more often than if you had a small amount of just skin cells from something that's been touched. So it's like if you have a jar of blue M&Ms and you have a handful of red ones in there, what's the likelihood of pulling out a blue one? You're going to pull out more blue, so those chemicals are going to come and react more often with all that DNA that's from the blood versus something that's been touched.
Let's talk about your findings with regards to Q2. What did you conclude?
So sample Q2 appeared to be a mixture of DNA from more than one individual. I was able to determine a major contributor and then the minor. The major profile is clearly discernible, meaning that I can clearly tell which of those alleles belong to the major contributor to that sample. And of that, comparing that to the standards that I had, a sample from Cerner Mu matched the major profile sample Q2.
Looking back at that blood stain on the wall, would that, based off your testing for serology, determining that it was human blood that you were finding in the swabbing, and then your further DNA work, would you conclude that that blood was, the source of that blood came from Cerner?
Yes, I would.
Let's move now to Q10. What is Q10?
Q10 is represented in the pictures as item number 25, which was the reddish-brown stain at the top of the stairs. Again, if you look at Exhibit 88, that's looking from the main living room area towards the kitchen, and around that corner is going down the stairs, and that's item 25.
And did you do the DNA work on that as well?
Yes, I did.
Is this the chart, your findings there?
Yes, it is.
And let's talk about your conclusions from that DNA work. What did you conclude?
Can I explain one thing back on that other chart?
Certainly.
The chart now looks different. Instead of having two separate charts, it now has, we have one chart. The reason for that is that the amplification kit that we used has now changed. So we went from using Profiler Plus and Cofiler to now we're using Identifiler Plus. So that's why now in Identifiler Plus, all of those allele or all those loci are now into one kit versus having to use two separate kits. That's why there's a difference in that chart.
And then your findings with regards to Q10.
Yes, so sample Q10 was a mixture of DNA from more than one individual, and it exhibited a major profile again, and that major profile matched that of Cerner Mu.
Now, with regards to the prior Q2 and Q10 here, were you able to determine a minor profile on either of those samples?
There was a minor profile detected, but my analysis of those minor profiles, because of the level that they were at and the complexity of the minor profile, no conclusions could be reached regarding those.
When you talk about complexity, is that because there's potentially more than one person or individual DNA profiles on that?
Yeah, there's a couple things that can play into why a sample would fall into that, where no conclusions could be reached. Either there's, you can see the major profile very clearly, and you can see minor profile, and then even below that, you might see indications of another person. So you've got this real low, the minor profile could be a low-level area that you're seeing some peaks, but you're not seeing some. So just being a very conservative on those. We don't want to, you know, I don't want to make some kind of statement to the fact that, you know, those samples, I'm not knowing exactly where those samples are or being able to, knowing for a fact that I can see all of those samples. Some of them might be below what I can see. So the level that they're at, the complexity of it, if it's a lot of people, you know, three or four or more, it just makes that interpretation a lot difficult, and sometimes you can't make a conclusion based off of it.
These two samples were on the walls, correct?
Right.
So people coming, brushing by, touching it, or otherwise having some contact with it, could put layer and layer of DNA upon it.
Right. Could be an explanation why there is so much there. Yes.
But you were able to determine the major profile.
That's correct.
And that being determined.
Correct.
And for your serology, you were able to determine that the source of that DNA is coming from the blood that you're seeing in the mouth.
Correct.
Move now to Q11. Where is this sample at?
Q11 is on the handrail of the stairwell, so that's item 24 in the crime scene photo.
And then did you do the DNA work and obtain results?
Yes, I did.
What were your findings with regards to Q11?
Again, this was a mixture of DNA, more than one individual. Again, it had a clear major profile. That major profile matched that of Sooner Mu.
That handrail, you also tested positive for human blood.
Right.
So the source of that would have been the blood from Sooner Mu.
Right.
Let's talk about statistical probabilities. What is meant by that?
So, in forensics, to give any weight behind these matches or things like that, we do statistical calculations based off of the frequency of these alleles or frequencies of these profiles. So the way that they're calculated is we use some data that has been collected through a pool of people. The FBI actually did the study, published all the information. We use their data. Use a pool of individuals where they got their DNA profiles, looked at how many times was the 11 allele detected in this pool of people. If it's, you know, so it's detected so many times out of those individuals, that now becomes the frequency. How often is it detected in that pool of individuals? So the way we calculate and what the statistics we calculate is the random match probability. What that states is, what's the probability of selecting out in the general population, selecting an individual that would match this question sample from our crime scene? What's the weight behind that?
And with regards to Q1, Q2, Q10, and Q11, where you said that either the single source or the major profile was that of matches that of certain mean. Did you determine the probability of being able to pull a DNA profile out randomly that would match that of certain mean and these question samples?
Yes.
Can you tell us what your findings were and explain them for us?
Yes. So, the probability of selecting an unrelated individual at random from the population matching Q1. The major profile of Q2, Q10, and Q11 is approximately 1 in 1.5 quintillion in Caucasians, 1 in 94 quintillion in Blacks, 1 in 390 quadrillion in Southwestern Hispanics, and 1 in 3.9 quadrillion in the Thai population.
What is a quintillion and a quadrillion?
A quadrillion is they're really large numbers. Quadrillion is a number with 15 zeros behind it. Quintillion is a number with 18 zeros behind it. So extremely large numbers.
And to what magnitude is it above a billion?
Well, a billion is as you can see there, 10 to the ninth. So a quintillion is double that, or to the ninth power, so 8 to the 18th power. I like to look at it as, to make it simple, the number of zeros behind it. So if you can look at the example of a quadrillion, that one with 15 zeros behind it is quite a bit, where a billion only has 9 zeros.
So the probability of finding somebody out there randomly was in the quadrillion and the quintillion.
Correct.
Now I'd like to move to another sample, Q12. This is found, it was the marker 19 found in State Exhibit 83 and 84. Were you able to do testing on this particular sample?
Yes, I did.
And did you get results from that sample?
I did.
Or seen in this chart. Tell us your findings.
So, with this sample, I found that it was a mixture of DNA from more than one individual. In this case, I could not distinguish between a discernible major and minor profile. So that meant that a lot of the locations, those peak heights, were pretty similar, and I couldn't distinguish a major contributor versus a minor.
And were you, so when you have this non-distinguishable super DNA, are you able to say that people are in there, or is it more for exclusion purposes?
When I do my comparison, so I have my question sample and my question alleles, then I'm doing a comparison to those known reference samples. What I'm looking for are points of exclusion. So, you know, if I'm looking at one location and it's a 12-13, I look at my reference sample, if there's a 12-14, then there's a point of exclusion. That is a point where they don't match. But if it's a 12-13 and a 12-13, then I'll move to the next one and look to see. So I'm looking for points of exclusion to exclude individuals from contributing to the question samples.
Were you able to exclude individuals?
In this sample Q12, yes, I was able to exclude several individuals.
You want me to identify those individuals?
Sure. I excluded Isar Met, Po D, Cartoon Wa, Ker Ker Po, Kai Kai Po, Sunday Mu, Mang Mio Mai, and Meet Kai. Sorry for the pronunciation.
That's fine. We've had to learn too. Were you able not to exclude certain individuals?
Yes, there were two individuals that I could not exclude. Those two individuals were Serner Mu and Kunu.
Now, I'd like to go back to that particular exhibit. Let's look at State Exhibit 83. There was a marker number 18 that was nearby. Is that correct?
Yes.
With regards to marker 18, it's seen in State Exhibit 149 and then more closely in 150. Did you attempt to perform the serology on this test, the Castlemyer test, while on sealant?
Yes, I did.
Tell us what happened as you did that.
So, just like all the other reddish-brown stains, a small sample was swabbed and the Castlemyer test performed, and this item tested negative for Castlemyer, which meant no indications of it.
And you mentioned before that you found upstairs lots of items that look like red-brown stains, and you said that there was a spittoon or some other source there.
Right.
In State Exhibit 147, do you remember where this was at, this photograph?
I believe that's one of the upstairs bedrooms.
And then State Exhibit 148,
and that's the what I was referencing to, this reddish brown liquid that saw in containers, and you can see on the side. I mean, it looks reddish brown, similar to what blood would look like. That's what we saw at the scene.
With regards to this particular question sample, question 12, that's on this wall here, we previously mentioned that there was a little bit of blood, unlike the one that was on the west wall, where there was a lot of blood.
Right.
What happens as you reduce the amount of blood versus now looking at a wall where there's potential touch or other type of DNA stuffage?
Well, if you remember from that photograph of sample Q12, the blood stain on the wall is smaller. There's not a lot of it there. It's not real heavy or thick. So, in my opinion, of getting a mixture of two people isn't that uncommon based off of a wall where it's a living quarters, either people have been touching or now knowing what that reddish-brown liquid is, it was something that was spit out, that was potentially mixed in. There's, to me, a good explanation to why you could see a mixture in that particular sample.
So if you were informed that Kudim, for example, that's in the sample, is an older gentleman who has difficulty with lots of things, walking, and also used a betel nut spitting and so forth, would that help explain why we might see him in the sample?
If he was down in that basement, or spent time down there, or did that, those things, you know, fall against the wall, fell against the wall, or used that spitting stuff, and it got on the wall, that could be a good explanation to why he's in there.
Were you able to generate statistics on this Q12?
Yes.
And what was the result of that?
This statistic is a little bit different. Rather than being a single source where we can do the random match probability, we do what's called the probability of exclusion and the probability of inclusion. So what it states is a mixture of DNA from more than one person was obtained from sample Q12. The donor sample V1 and E2, so V1 is Sernermu and E2 is Kunu, could not be excluded as possible contributors to that mixture. Based on the national database provided by the FBI, the probability of selecting an individual at random who could be excluded as a possible contributor to the mixture at these particular loci, D8, D7, D3, O1, D13, D18, D5, and FGA, are approximately 99.98138%, or all but one in every 5,371 Caucasians. 99.97912%, or all but one in every 4,789 blacks, or 99.97708%, or all but one in 4,363 Southwestern Hispanics. And then additionally, doing the comparison to the Thai population, would be 99.9744558%, or all but one in 3,914 Thai.
Much lower number than what we were seeing in the quadrillion and quintillion.
Right, and that's because now we're looking, instead of just that single source profile where there's only two alleles, now we're looking at places that have three or four alleles, which means the combination of those alleles are a lot more frequently seen. So the pool has gotten bigger, that more people could potentially match. That's why those numbers or statistics are a little bit lower.
I'd like to talk to you about some other type of DNA that you did on this clothing of these or that. With regards to his clothing, were you able to test a t-shirt for this?
Yes.
And let's start off first with regards to where on that T-shirt and what did you test?
The T-shirt I tested in the laboratory. It was a white T-shirt. I found reddish-brown stains on the inside front of the T-shirt, which would be somewhere right kind of chest high, maybe right below the chest line. And they were just small, little speckled reddish-brown stains, so it wasn't like a big red-brown stain, but it was a little smaller speckled reddish-brown stain.
I'm going to show you State Exhibit 40. You probably don't recognize this, but have you ever seen this photograph before?
I have not.
That would indicate, if I told you that this was a picture of a chest area level with a mark on that chest area level, would that T-shirt area that you were testing line up with this particular spot here, right here in the center of the chest area?
And the head's up?
The head would be up here. As you can see, there's a nipple to the chest, of the left chest breast of that, and then the right would be there. So this would be the center line. Would that be consistent in the area that you were seeing on the T-shirt, this red brown stain?
I would say it's close in the general vicinity of that same staining. Not knowing exactly where that T-shirt would sit, but in my, you know, as I pointed right to my sternum area. So that's pretty close to, from the picture I'm looking at.
Thank you. Was that item Q7?
Yes, it was.
And were you able to generate findings with regards to Q7?
Yes, I was.
What findings did you come in?
Q7 was a mixture of DNA from more than one individual. The sample did exhibit a discernible major profile again, and that major profile was consistent with sample S1 from ESARMET.
And were you able to exclude other samples or persons?
Yes, I was.
Who were you able to exclude?
Those were not listed there, but I want to read them correctly. Well, in my original DNA report, I excluded Cerner Mu. And then in additional DNA reports later on, based off of, again, that same complexity of the minor profile, that no conclusions could be made regarding contributors to that minor profile.
And that was all those various individuals that you mentioned before.
Right. But I do have that there were alleles that are in that sample for Q7 that are not consistent with any of the standards or reference standards that I had from any of those individuals.
With regards to the major sample of that of ESARMET, were you able to draw some statistics from that?
Yes, I was.
And what was the probability that the stain, that red-brown stain that you saw that you tested for DNA on the inner shirt of ESARMET being that of ESARMET?
Well, again, the random match probability is talking about the likelihood of selecting somebody in the general population that would match that question sample. For Q7, it is approximately 1 in 6.9 quintillion. 6.9 quintillion in Caucasians, 1 in 13 quintillion in Blacks, and 1 in 100 quintillion in Southwestern Hispanics.
I'd like to talk to you finally about some serology and DNA work you did on the defendant's Levi jackets. I'm going to show you State Exhibit 105. What is that photograph of?
That's a photograph that I took in the laboratory at my workstation of the Levi jacket that I performed serology testing on.
And are we looking at the front or the back of that jacket?
That is the back.
Did you perform serology on that back jacket?
Yes, I did.
How do you go about looking for stains and identifying them and marking them?
So, in this case, I was looking for reddish-brown stains because I knew there was a homicide. I knew that there was, had been blood at the scene. So, I do a visual look of the jacket, so I look at the insides, the front, the back, all different areas that I can. If I need to, I can use some bright lighting. We have in our laboratory kind of a magnifying glass that's got real bright lighting around it. I've got flashlights and other tools to help with the lighting if I need. So that's the initial stages, is to look for anything that's reddish-brown stain. Once I find something of interest or something I want to test, then I'll simply circle it with a black Sharpie.
I'm going to show you State Exhibit 106. Is this that same jacket now with you marking it up?
It is. And in this case, I actually used a silver Sharpie so that you could see, or that I could see when I was testing, which stains I was interested in testing. So all those circles are areas that potentially reddish-brown stains that I'd like to do further testing on.
And for illustration, you identified those stains with letters, is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Stain A through H, right?
Right.
I'd like to show you some exhibits and have you identify them, what you were looking at in particular. Let's go to State Exhibit 107. What do we see here?
So that is the back of the same jean jacket. That's the stain A. You can see that I've circled reddish-brown stain and labeled an A next to that circle. Now I've also got a little marker card in there that includes my case number, the item number, the date, and my initials on there.
Did you perform serology on stain A? Start first with the Castleman test.
Yes, I did.
What did you find on stain A?
It was KM, Castleminer test was positive.
And with regards to State Exhibit 108, what do we see there?
That again is the back of the jacket. I've circled another reddish-brown stain. I've identified it as stain B. Also have my same little marker in there that includes my case number, item number, date, and my initials.
And did you do the Castleminer test on this?
Yes, I did. And it was positive for indications of blood.
Move on to State Exhibit 109. What do we see in this photograph?
This is stain C on that jacket. Again, you can see I have the stain circled, the C designating it as the item or the sample C. Again, with my marker, including my case number, date, item number, and initial.
This test positive with the Castleminer?
Yes.
Let's move on to State Exhibit 110. What do we see here?
And this is representing stain D. It kind of has two circles connected with a line. I designated that all as stain D. Again, it's got my little placard with case number, item number, date, and initial.
In this particular photograph, do we also see E or stain E?
Yes, you do.
And then at the bottom, another almost top part of the circle?
Yeah, and that would be stain F.
With regards to stain D, did you test it positive? Did you test it with the Casper?
Yes.
And what was the result of that?
It was positive.
Going back to these various stains, you noted that there was a stain E, F, G, and H. Did you perform Castlemyre tests on those?
Yes, I did.
And what were the results of those particular samples?
Those all were negative for the Castlemyre test.
And dropping them out, and just focusing now on stain A, B, and C, did you perform the confirmatory test, the hue direct test, on those particular samples to determine whether or not they were hue?
Yes, I did.
And what were your findings with regards to all four of those, stain A, B, C, and D?
All four of those were positive for human blood.
With regards to each of those items that you tested, could you talk generally about or compare their what they look like to each other? What did they look like to each other?
I noted, you know, as I was doing this, that all four of those samples, pretty identical in color and look and size and shape. They were all, you know, roughly the same kind of size. Shapes were a little bit different, as you saw in some of the photographs. But one thing that really kind of caught my attention was that they were in a linear, straight line kind of fashion down the back of that jacket.
From your observations, would they be consistent? Would it be consistent to say that they were all placed at the same time?
In my thinking and in my experience, that being in such a nice linear fashion, I would suspect that they would have been placed there all at the same time.
In addition to the linear fashion, you also talked about that they were in the same size, color, consistency to
right,
each other.
Right.
Would that also be a factor in your determination that it was more likely that they were placed at the same time?
Yes.
Did you perform DNA on these various areas?
I did on two of the areas.
Would that be seen in this diagram with Q6 and Q9?
Yes.
In particular, Q6 was your stain A, and Q9 was the stain C.
Correct.
Why did you pick these two particular locations?
Well, based off of the fact that I thought they were deposited kind of at the same time because of the way they were deposited in that linear fashion. It's not uncommon for us to select a representative sample. So because the color, the shape, all of those things kind of played into my thinking, that I took originally sample A and tested that one with my original DNA testing. And then later on, I was asked to go back and retest sample C and to run the DNA testing on that.
Did you come up with findings on this particular sample?
Yes, I did.
What were your findings with regards to those two particular samples, Q6 and Q9?
So both of them, Q6 and Q9, both appeared to have originated from a single female source, and that compared to the reference samples I had matched that of Cerner Moo.
Again, a single female source means that there's just kind of a clean sample, right?
Correct.
No other mixture of other person is the enemy.
Right.
And what was the statistical probability of the match that Sernamu versus a random person of Azerbaijan?
So again, applying the random match probability, which is selecting an individual from the general population that would match that question profile, was 1 in 1.5 quintillion in Caucasians, 1 in 94 quintillion in blacks, 1 in 390 quadrillion in southwestern Hispanics, and 1 in 3.9 quadrillion in the Thai population.
Just one.
Great. The lunch period, again, please do not speak with anyone or among yourselves about this case. Do not